get life's fair share.
Sound out Steel Pulse, a band from Birmingham, kicking off this week's broadcast of Radio Resistance Chesterfield, with a track entitled Handsworth Revolution. Now this week, back in the year 1955, we saw the beginning of the Montgomery bus boycott in America. This began on the 1st of December after Rosa Parks was arrested for refusing to give up her seat to a white passenger. The reason she gave for the refusal was that she was tired. And she doesn't just mean tired after a hard day's work. She meant tired of all of the discrimination, all of the oppression, all of the racism that black people endured, especially in the southern US states at the time because of the Jim Crow laws. And the Montgomery bus boycott, which she sparked, also kick-started the civil rights movement in America. And this next track is, of course, dedicated to Rosa Parks. It's the sound of EQ Live, track entitled Rosa Parks.
You know, not too long ago, my people couldn't ride on the front of the bus. But now we
rocking on the bus. Had a long day at work. Yeah, I know your feet hurt. Put some soda around the rim, and some lime in your cup. And if you're feeling real good, girl, we about to go nuts. And when the gospel is over, we ain't getting off the bus. What up?
Everybody's jumping with their hands up. Got this bus rocking in, we might just flip it over.
Yeah, sound there, VQ Live, track entitled Rosa Parks. Now, this week, Boris Johnson has thrown off his harmless buffoon image with a rabid rant. About 16% of people allegedly not having the IQ to get on in life. Now, not only is this absolutely insulting to people who can't get a job, to people who are thrown on the scrap heap by his Tory government's own policies, it's also a load of rubbish because IQ tests have actually been discredited over the years. For starters, although they're acclaimed as a absolute measure of intelligence, they are not. They do depend on a level of education. You can train for IQ tests, and the results can and do change. And also, it's very Eurocentric, in fact, British culture-centric. Indeed, some questions on the IQ tests are very culture-specific, not just to British culture, but to past British culture. However, that doesn't stop IQ scores being used as the linchpin of a number of things, notably hideously right-wing theories such as the theory in the hideously racist Bell Curve book, which implied that black people are genetically less intelligent than white people, allegedly. Now, the question of whether or not intelligence is in our genes is a topic all in its own right, which I hope to cover at some point in the future. But in any case, even if IQ did come into it, the fact of the matter is that intelligence is not the only factor as to how far you get on in life. I mean, there's the university graduates who are on the dole or in low-paid casual work. And at the same time, people born into privilege and money often stay privileged, whatever their talents or lack thereof. The real factor which keeps some people poor and others rich isn't the level of intelligence or even the level of education necessarily, it's class, and it's the capitalist system which Boris Johnson and his Tory government support and which Boris Johnson seems to have done pretty damn well out of. Speaking of the capitalist system and people who seem to do well out of privilege, this next track is by Steve White and the Protest Family, Merchant Bankers.
Well, I've heard them on the radio, seen them on TV, there's a budget deficit, which they're blaming on me, and they're coming for my pension, coming for my pay. Profit for people is the way we live today. Meanwhile, the subsidised banks are sitting on their asses, what they've robbed support to pay the bonus earning classes. They're merchant bankers, merchant bankers, merchant bankers.
Workers!
Well, they love Milton Friedman, hate Karl Marx, love Margaret Thatcher, hate the working class, cause they spent the money on speculation, gambling the finance of the population. And they don't give a damn about you or me, cause they got rich messing up the economy. They're merchant bankers, merchant bankers, merchant bankers.
Wankers!
Well, they're hedge fund managing, economy damaging, subprime lending, bad debt spending, short selling, light selling, rule bending, bad lending, dodgy credit rated, deregulated, CDO inventing, law circumventing, scrutiny hating, recession creating. Bankers, merchant bankers, merchant bankers.
Workers!
This is Radio Resistance News coming to you courtesy of Socialist Worker Newspaper. Tory Chancellor George Osborne says Britain is booming. He wants us to believe that his austerity plans are working and that the economy is out of crisis. But that's not what it feels like for millions of ordinary people who are struggling to get by. Those in work have seen their wages falling behind rising prices, while those out of work battle to survive as benefits are cut and the media scapegoats them as scroungers. At the same time, the earnings of the fat cat bankers and bosses are at an all-time high and getting higher. We must fight back. Home Secretary Theresa May's barbaric attempts to deport desperately ill hunger striker Issam Rouhatsa to Nigeria has temporarily failed. May is showing out to the Tories and the right-wing press by trying to prove how tough she is on immigrants. Partly for this reason, decisions on deporting hunger strikers are now always referred to the Home Secretary. Workers across four unions in colleges and universities across Britain went on strike together on Tuesday of this week. The walkout was an escalation of a dispute over pay. Higher education workers previously walked out on the 31st of October. A new law to crack down on protests in Egypt has been met by many demonstrations, which have continued even after police killed a student. Protests took place mainly in Cairo, but also in many other cities across Egypt. Protests are continuing despite the government's crackdown. Also in this week's Socialist Worker, firefighters in Scotland are campaigning against cuts which are being pushed through despite the recent helicopter crash in Glasgow showing the need for a properly funded fire and rescue service. Greek workers are rallying to defend the newspaper Workers' Solidarity, which is under threat from a lawsuit brought against them by the Golden Dawn Nazis. Investigative reporter Joe Miscahill set out to expose the slaughter of the Western military in the name of the War on Terror in his new film Dirty Wars. Assembly lines from their first use by the Ford Car Company to the present day. A huge number of damning documents were burned in secret to hide the shame of Britain's brutal empire. And how reactionary right-wing protests in Thailand are attempting to force a coup. You can read Socialist Worker online at www.socialistworker.co.uk, or you can buy Socialist Worker in Chesterfield Town Centre each Saturday outside Primark from 11am through till 12:30pm. If you'd like Socialist Worker delivered, visit us on the paper sale at the Thursday night branch meetings, phone or text 07919 486 101, or email swpchesterfield@tesco.net. Socialist Worker is your paper. Buy it, read it, sell it.
Going to the pictures, see the Late Late Show. You're told that you're a fire risk, so the wheelchair has to go. You're in your seat, turn around, you wave your wheels goodbye. You don't need many guesses who's gonna be the first to fly. But if you try to argue, that's my leg you're taking away. You can guarantee there'll always be somebody there who'll say, you got a chip on your shoulder, got a really bad attitude. Is it any wonder people treat you the way they do? You really should be grateful for all we do for you. Be a quiet little crip without a chip. Waiting on the platform to board the 905. You travel with the livestock, least it proves that you're alive. You can make friends with the pigeons there and keep each other warm. There's no heathen in that cage and it's brewing up a storm. No clamps to hold you down, you feel your body slipping away. But if you moan, it's 10 to 1, the guard will come and say, you got a chip on your shoulder, got a really bad attitude. Is it any wonder people treat you the way they do? You really should be grateful for all we do for you. And be a quiet little crip without a chip. I've never done a marathon, I'd sooner drink and smoke. But what's your opening question? Are you that TV wheelchair bloke? And how'd you get like that then? Was it some great tragedy? I was stuntman in Jaws 2, and I really earned me fee. And I sit here and wonder what you hear and what you see. Are you looking at the chair? Or are you listening to me? Got a chip on your shoulder, got a really bad attitude. Is it any wonder people treat you the way they do? You really should be grateful for all we do for you. Be a quiet little crip without a chip. Oh yeah, be a quiet little crip without a chip. That's right, be a quiet little crip. Quiet little crip. Quiet little crip without a chip.
Yeah, sound heavy and Stanton, chip on his shoulder. Now, last week I said that we'd bring up the subject of pornography this week. First of all, do we support women who campaign against the likes of Page 3 and The Sun and pornographic magazines? Well, absolutely. Just as we support students who are wanting porn banned from campuses and from student union shops. The fact is that porn is oppressive to women. It does stereotype and degrade women, gives a very alienated view of sexuality and a very alienated view on what perfect women should look like, and in doing so it promotes sexism. At the same time though, I've got to say I'm not so keen on giving the estate yet more powers to ban porn. I mean, we're seeing internet censorship, we're seeing a plan to have ISPs, internet service providers, rather bring in porn filters which you have to opt out of, and this is all porn. Not just kiddie porn, which I'll come on to later. And the only trouble with these filters is where is it going to stop? I mean, they'll start by banning porn, and the trouble is the same infrastructure can be used to block anti-government and anti-capitalist websites. And alright, yes, you can opt out of it, but if they start banning anti-establishment websites and you go opting out on that of that, well, the establishment will have your cards marked with all that that entails. As for what we can do about pornography and the problems associated with it, as well as supporting grassroots movements, I think a really good start would also be for the unionisation of all people, especially all women who work as models in the porn industry, because I believe that, like prostitutes, although they don't do an ideal job, although they do a job which I hope wouldn't exist under socialism, they should be unionised, simply so that they can not only fight for better working conditions, let alone wages, but that they can have more power as to how far they choose to go and how far they want to go, instead of the bosses pressurising them into doing ever more degrading things. And back to the music now, along the lines of women's liberation, is the sound of the Eurythmics featuring Aretha Franklin. Sisters are doing it for themselves.
Time to change. I know that it's no longer true.
Yeah, Sound of the Eurythmics featuring Aretha Franklin. Sisters are doing it for themselves. Now, as you know, we're not one here at Radio Resistance Chesterfield to duck a sort of a thorny issue. And, yeah, one exception to me sort of talking about pornography, one which I think should be totally banned under all circumstances, is child pornography. Because that is child abuse by proxy. Child pornography is nothing but photographs of child abuse, and looking at it or whatever, you perpetuate child abuse, and it should totally be banned. And in my opinion, likewise for animal porn. However, there are still complications even with that, namely what is defined as child porn. I mean, we've recently seen the case of the Iranian disabled person in Bristol who was arrested for allegedly taking photos of kids on his street, because that's sort of seen as child porn, and he was of course released without charge, but that didn't stop him being murdered. On a more widespread level, there's now bans on taking photos of kids, not just at places like swimming pools, but at discos, playgrounds, nativity plays, etc. In a way, we're back to my previous discussion on general porn and the blocker of porn on the internet. Does that mean that artistic photos of women and paintings of nude women from the Middle Ages may end up being blocked unless you opt out? But back to child porn, I think that for all my opinions of charities having their faults, I do think that the NSPCC do give a pretty good definition of what child porn is, as being child abuse images. Now, the last time I checked, kids dancing at discos and kids in nativity plays didn't count as child abuse, so I don't see how photos of said can possibly be classed as child abuse images. Now, that doesn't stop me original point. True, child porn is evil and must be stopped. At the same time, though, I'm sceptical whether this alone would stop child abuse. I mean, child abuse has a number of factors what cause it, but two of the big ones have got to be the twisting of sexuality under capitalism into what is effectively a power game. This also leads to the rape of adult women. And also the fact that children have the least power in society, and even to this day there's often an attitude that kids shouldn't have any rights, and this, if you ask me, has led to a perfect storm which has led to child abuse, including child sexual abuse. If you have any comments on that, please do contact us and let us know, and we will air your views. Back to the music now. This one is going out from Tim of the Derbyshire Unemployed Workers Centre to all members of the EDL, BNP and any other fascist groups out there. Sound of Kendall Smith. Dryland tourist.
But that you don't like black people, but you love the island. You are a dryland tourist. You don't like black man or even woman yet. Every winter you're gone off for an island. If you catch suntan in your head, in your back, and also your hand. And then complain about the one immigration. Never say a thing about your migration. Out of the England into the island. Invade Kitishan, you invade the Bajan. Invade Jamaican without consideration. You don't take clothes, you just taking corruption. You don't take money, just exploitation. Park your body on our nice beaches, drinking cocktail just like leeches. Man, if you did see them crosses, the only thing to do, you run like blazes. So hear the British when they gone foreign. Could a coroner give me some jib?
Why ain't it in that? Now they speak funny. Bloody foreigners. Ha! You don't like black people, but you love with island. You are a dryland tourist. Remember that you don't like black people, but you love with island. You are a dryland tourist. On my island, you impose your structure. For me in England, well, it's just another matter. If I take up myself, lie down on a beach, police would come and arrest me with beef. But you lie down with your pale color skin, you forcing my sister into sin. With your crisp white shorts, your nice silk shirt, your new deck shoes, and you just a flirt. With your pina colada, your rum and banana, me a drink water and eat cassava. It wouldn't be so bad if you would just consider for a second, a minute, or even an hour, just how your actions causing pressure on the people in the Caribbean. This poor, you're foreign investment, commercial brain. You're causing trouble, you're causing pain. We don't really mind if you come to visit, but all that we ask is you just don't chuck it. Cause you call us jungle bunny, coon and nigga. You tell us how you doing like with skin color, but you cock up in a chair and wait for winter. For the holiday company, travel brochure. You don't like black people, but you love with island. You are a dryland tourist. Remember that you don't like black people, but you love with island.
Yeah, sound there of Kendall Smith, track entitled Dryland Tourist. Now, last week I said that I'd try to edit down last week's meeting on Can There Be a Revolution in Britain to try to edit some of the highlights and try to edit out some of the less relevant bits. Well, on the final part, I failed. I couldn't find any less relevant bits, so here it is, near enough in its entirety. Mark asking, can there be a revolution in Britain?
So tonight's meeting, Russell Brand v Paxman. Is revolution possible in Britain?
Right, okay, how can I compete with Russell Brand? I mean, if you were sort of walking into Smith's one day a few weeks ago, you would have seen the New Statesman, which is like the internal bulletin of Ed Miliband and everything, and there on the picture would be this incredibly handsome guy, Russell Brand. But he looks a bit like Che Guevara. And it says revolution across the cover, and you think, well, what on earth is going on here? And you can get a T-shirt with Russell Brand, and he looks like that image of Che Guevara from the 60s, which in turn made Che Guevara look like Christ. In a very moribund sort of magazine, they've given it over to Russell Brand, and the theme is revolution. And then it goes on mainstream television. And you just think, hang on, am I seeing things? And there is, you know, Paxo, the arch griller of moribund politicians, really giving our hero a sort of grilling. And what's happening? He's fighting back. And he's fighting back really, really well. And you say to yourself, well, what is he reflecting? Where is this coming from? Why now? I mean, some of the things that he said, you get this sense of passion and anger. And he talks about the reasons why someone would want a revolution. Of course, he talks about the destruction of the environment, the inequality in society. He talks about how the welfare attacks on the vulnerable and the poor. And he talks about how revolution can overcome what he sees as the apathy of people. He mentions something like 500 people in the United States own as much money as 86 million people, the poorest layers of Americans, own themselves. He talks about the way the bankers got away with it. I mean, I dug up the figure for the bankers and the economic crisis of 2008, and the figure is $13 trillion. And it's just vanished. Well, we ain't got it. Someone has got it. It's just literally disappeared. And you suddenly think, well, hang on. This guy is reflecting something. He's reflecting that sort of air of anger and resentment that is out there. And then he goes on to say that he's talking about, he wants a revolution. Why? He wants the redistribution of wealth. And here's the bit that I really liked. that profit should be a dirty word. Filthy, a filthy word. That I'm not sort of saying that we should bring profits down or that we should, you know, worry about how profits are, whether this company's making profit. No, actually, it's a filthy word. And he says, doesn't he, in the interview, if someone is making a profit, that means someone else is losing out. And he thought, hang on, Paxman's listening to this, and this is going out on BBC One. So you get that sense, is that he is reflecting something, that he's aware that there's this anger. And then he goes on in the interview and he talks about voting. And he says, basically, don't vote. Now, I'm always reminded of the Scottish comedian Billy Connolly, who said, don't vote, it only encourages them. Or the joke that was around when I was a student was, Guy Fawkes, the only man to enter Parliament with honest intentions. And they go on and on, don't they? Because, again, this reflects, you know, it's not just a cynicism, it's like people saying Parliament isn't enough. You know, they're all the same as each other. Tweedledum and Tweedledee. Where's the alternative? And Russell Brand gets up and says that there needs to be an alternative. So clearly, if you're particularly if you're a young person watching this, you're saying to yourself, this guy's speaking for me. You know, he is representing something. And, you think, well, crikey, we've got to engage with this. I suppose the question is, it poses a number of things, but obviously he poses the question, is there an alternative? Do we need a better world? And obviously we do. And then he poses the much more thoughtful question about how do we get there? It's really quite uncanny when you think about the questions of, you know, like, do we need a revolution? And you think about the issues of social inequality. You can go into any of the figures, but I mean, obviously what you have to say to yourself is that if you think about the post-war period, social inequality closed. There was a movement of money and wealth and income from the rich to the poor. But from about 1975 onwards, which is frighteningly 40 years ago, it's actually gone the other way. And now that process is accelerated. A husband and wife from Scotland, perhaps soon to be independent, wanted to go on holiday skiing in the Alps for 3 weeks with their 2 children, 7 bodyguards, personal assistant and a nanny. So they decided to book 3 weeks in Switzerland, and needless to say, they travelled by private jet and helicopter. When they got to their ski lodge, they weren't just welcomed with drinks and everything. They had a lone piper who piped them in, and that where they were staying was built by a crack team of artists and craftsmen and interior designers who spent an awful lot of money and actually had antiques that had been bought in Florence and Paris. There was a vaulted art gallery in the lodge with paintings curated by international art connoisseurs. Just in case you were tired of skiing, you could go swimming. And the spa had, it sounds all right to me, this, the spa had a hammam, a sauna and a hot tub on the terrace warmed by an open fire. You may ask yourself, how much did this cost? Well, I'll tell you, 706,400 quid. I mean, if anyone's been following the rather fruity, the fruity sort of trial that's going on involving Nigella Lawson and what's his name, Saatchi, you do ask yourself how these people managed to spend more. Nigella was only spending £7,000 a month on, you know, it's quite modest, really. But anyway, so we've gone on holiday. Let's go and buy a house. So let's be a bit more modest. This is a flat in London. Doesn't look too posh, does it? Somewhere tower block. Oh, actually, Southeast 1 Union Street on the South Bank. In fact, the cheapest place, which presumably is only one bedroom, 820,000, going up to a very modest 2,250,000. I mean, God forbid, what on earth do these people do? Crikey, if you live in London, you must be cheeked by jowl by this wealth. And you can't, I mean, who can afford to live there? Even someone as relatively well paid as a teacher or for that matter, a doctor, it just strikes you of the absolute horror and inequality of our society. So people recognise this, and it isn't getting any better. The recession seems to go on and on and on and on. Has anyone noticed? Apparently we are in some sort of revival now. Well, it hasn't hit our part of the world, and it certainly probably won't have hit most of the people in the streets of London. So brand is coming from somewhere, and the first port of call must be the Occupy movement, and he actually mentions the Occupy movement, that fabulous phrase that was invented by an activist in New York: we're the 1%, they're the 99%. So that Occupy movement, which has gone away for now, I'm sure it will come back in some form, of course had its roots, partially at least, in the huge anti-war movement. And, you know, some of us were on that massive demonstration 10 years ago where 2 million people walked, you know, down in London against the war. It hasn't gone away. It's still out there. You trace it further back and you talk about the sort of anti-globalisation movement in the late 90s. And again, that anger where people were fighting, you know, in Genoa and those sorts of demonstrations. So he's coming from somewhere. And the most important thing about what he's posing is that there's an alternative. All those movements posed an alternative. All those movements were saying there has to be something better than this, and that lovely phrase, another world is possible. And of course it has its roots even deeper if you think about the women's movement, the gay rights movement, the environmental movements, which were, they were recharged in the 60s. And again, beloved of sociologists, that lovely, that phrase, new social movements, well, they're not particularly new, are they? So the thing is that you've got, he's building on something. He is saying that it will happen again, and he's right, it will, it's inevitable. But he's also saying that that is the alternative. And one of the things that you start to see about these movements is that they're like the tide. They ebb and flow. They go up and down. And I'm always reminded of one of the founding members of the SWP, Tony Cliff, who used to say, up like a firework, down like a stick or something, where, you know, this thing would go upwards and then it would just flutter down almost inevitably. So the question is then, what do you do with that energy and how do you harness that energy? And you would say to yourself, well, okay, well, in this country, we can see that there is the inequality, we can see that there's the anger, therefore we can see the possibility of revolution. We can start to see that Brand is right, that actually out there, there is the question that people want to change the world, what they need to... No, is how do you do that? Are the movements enough in itself? Well, I suppose we would say no, they're not. So where do we go? Well, I'll ignore the Labour Party because they're part of the Tweedledum, Tweedledee thing. But I do want to talk a bit about the trade unions. Because the obvious place to go is to... Many of us are members of a trade union. And you would say to yourself, well, OK, let's get stuck into the trade unions. And there's no harm in that. But what you find, of course, is that the trade unions have their own problems, is that their ideas are dominated by the ideas of reformism, and many of them are dominated by the idea that the working class has disappeared. And what you get is the sense, like in my union, the NUT, is you get that sense, like we had, I mean, if anyone was on the demonstration in Sheffield, was that that was utterly amazing. You had 3,000 teachers, overwhelmingly young, who were very, very angry indeed. And they've got a lot to be angry about. And I have to say, I don't subscribe to this view that seems to be knocking around a bit, that somehow teachers are separate from the rest of the working class. Actually, these young teachers are not. They are suffering a lot. They're finding it very difficult to find somewhere decent to live. They've got huge student loans. And what do they get at work? Management bearing down on them all the time, saying, you're not good enough, you're not good enough, you need to improve. Otherwise it's 13 weeks and you're out. So they're angry, and they're also frightened and scared, because when you're in front of the head and they're going, oh, you're not very good at your job, and you know, you've been in the profession a couple of years, you find yourself being absolutely scared to death. But you go out on the big demonstration and you feel that anger and you feel that collective spirit. So what does the leadership of the NUT do? They throw it all away. And why do they throw it away? Because they're scared. Because they're scared of what they might unleash, that they're scared of the potentiality of those strikes generalising. And perhaps even more importantly in terms of the trade unions and lost opportunities, is look what happened to Unite over Grangemouth. You get a sense where, I mean, again, there was a very strong argument, wasn't there, in the left about, you know, whether we should vote for McCluskey or not, and whether they're, and people say, oh, McCluskey's going to do it. And, like, we put up an alternative, oh, he won't do very well. Well, he did. But the thing is, and that was a hard argument, but now where are the people who said vote for McCluskey? Well, they've got nowhere to go because, I mean, anyone who had any sense would say to yourself, there was a dispute, an attack on the trade union, and Grangemouth was a place where you would occupy. You would go in and you would occupy Grangemouth because that would Russell Brand would be up there, wouldn't he? He'd have to be up there because he would say this is the same tactic as we are using. And that would put immense pressure on the government. And who knows, it would have been a risk, but you wouldn't have lost in the same scale as they did lose. Where basically, I think as far as I can work out, they went completely backwards, capitulated and ended up with a worse deal than if they'd just gone in and said, please. That's the reality. So again, the question is why did that occur? And I think this sense of potential is being lost. One of the things that strikes me is that this argument about the working class is that, strangely, there's been an argument has reappeared that it's completely changed. That there is a sense in which it's gone. The large workplaces have gone, and if you troll round Sheffield or something, you won't see any of the big workplaces. Of course, that is true. Except you do see big workplaces because a month after the big teachers' strike in Sheffield, lo and behold, there's a very successful higher education strike. And these things do have an impact. It's not the case that they're not important. So you feel that there's something going on and there are people working and there are people who want to fight the boss and everything. But then you sort of say to yourself, well, OK, let's just look out the bubble very quickly of Britain. Well, go to somewhere like Beijing. And if you think the working class has disappeared, Beijing is just like mind-blowing. It's a compact city, 20 million people. 18, 19 million of them are working class. Extraordinarily powerful. And it will, at some point, I'm convinced it will blow. They can't keep a lid on it. It is so powerful. So Beijing, Shanghai, go to Mumbai, it's the same. You know, look what's happened in Brazil. That stadium collapse in Sao Paulo, a city of 25 to 30 million people, there's the protests there and everything. So these things have an impact on us. And you can see the potential that is going on. So I think we have to argue very strongly that the working class is out there. Of course it has changed. But then the question is, that Brandel really tackles, is the question of democracy and organisation. And with addressing the question of democracy, is the question of organisation and what do we say? I think in many respects, one of the things that struck me about Brand's interview is that he is very sceptical of bourgeois democracy, and in many respects rightfully so. But on the other hand, we have to be reminded that it's not exclusively for the rich and the powerful. I mean, any study of history would say that working people fought for it. So one of the things, like if you go back in British history in the sort of early mid-19th century, is the Chartist movement, which is in many respects was a revolutionary movement, and was part and parcel of the sort of 1848 revolutions, is that they were fighting for the right to vote. And that right to vote was something that was a real struggle. And later on, you know, talking about in the suffragettes, fighting for the right to vote for women in the 20th century. These things are profoundly important. And if you say to yourself, well, okay, that sort of democracy isn't, in the period between 1905 and 1917, you know, the Bolsheviks, the revolutionaries, did stand and put people up in Parliament in St. Petersburg. Why? Because it was a platform. You could get up and have a go at the enemy who was just over there. You could do it. So the thing was that you realised that there were limitations on that, but actually you could actually, you know, engage and have that political debate with the class enemy. And of course, within our own tradition, we have had people stand, whether it's under you know, sort of like a Socialist Alliance banner or under respect. And for all his eccentricities, the impact of Galloway's election in Bethnal Green and the impact of Galloway in Bradford has been very, very real. So though there are limitations, there are circumstances in which we would see elections are very, very important. If you don't think they're very, very important and that we, you know, if we forsake the right to vote, well, look what Hitler did in Germany. In the end, what does he do? He gets into power in 33 and he removes the right to vote. And suddenly what seems to be a limiting factor is something that we would have all fought for. So the thing is that voting is absolutely critical. Now, who do you vote for? It's another issue. And I mean, fairly clearly, you would want to have some sort of alternative to Labour. But if you don't, if there is no alternative to Labour, then you would vote for Labour, the old one, with no illusions. And I love that phrase, to show the limitation, if they get into power, to show their limitations. And so the thing is that you get... Voting is really, really important. We don't want to remove democracy, we want to deepen that tradition. You know, like the tradition of democracy that we have now, born out of the American and French revolutions, is something that socialists build on. We don't ignore it. Though, would be sympathetic to those people who would say, OK, a plague on all their houses. So just to finish, what about the question of organisation? I mean, if we believe that there's a revolution is possible in this country, if we believe that it is desirable, what do we do? Well, you have to go back to that Bolshevik tradition. That image, I've got it very burnt into my mind because I was out there at Easter, is the Aurora, the battleship on the Neva. And it sails down the River Neva back in 1917 and fires the rocket and they storm the Winter Palace. And when you see, you stand on the steps where they came up to arrest the provisional government, it suddenly becomes really real. And you suddenly ask yourself a very, very simple question. Were they right to do it? And you said, yeah, we would have been for it. How did they get there? What sort of organisation got them there? How different is it now, 100 years? Of course, it is different, but how different is it, really? And one of the things that comes out is if you think about Lenin and Trotsky and the Bolshevik tradition, which is the one that we stand in, is that they were very practical about what was needed. People say Leninism and that the idea of Lenin is something where we do it this way, and it isn't. It's about saying what is the real circumstances in which we find ourselves and how do we adapt to those circumstances. And really there was a very simple formula that's established, and that's the notion that you have democracy, you discuss and you argue. And there are always arguments and there should always be arguments. But then you have unity in action. I think for two reasons. One is that you test your ideas in practice. If you have a load of people saying, yeah, right, at the meeting, I agreed with you, but then actually go and do something else, then how do you know that what you've decided is right if they're going around behind your back? On a more pragmatic level, if you don't have that unity in action, imagine a circumstance where you're on strike and someone agrees with you that they're going to be on strike and fighting for the strike, and then behind your back, they're not, and they undermine the strike and leave you exposed to management and bullying and everything. And that can be horrific. So the thing is that you need that type of organisation that can see the reality of the circumstances, that can generalise from them and say, what do we do? And really, it's to say to those people, the steam is going to reappear. It will come back again and again. But the party is the like the piston in the steam engine that moulds it in some sense. I don't want to sort of sound too sort of elitist about that, but really focuses that power and tries to learn those lessons as the steam necessarily goes round the system and evaporates and acts as a memory, but also acts as a guide to win those arguments for revolution. I think in that sense, all the conditions are there for a revolution in this country. And what we've got to do is make sure that we can engage with those conditions and build the organisation.
So there you have it. And don't go away, because after this next track we're going to have some of the contributions from the floor. Anyway, back to the music right now. Here's the sound of the Redskins, track entitled Kick Over the Statues.
Ah, Radio Resistance. Sun rahe
talking about how to improve democracy, and that and his idea was that everybody would have a positive vote, so they could vote for who they wanted, and also a negative vote, so that people could say who they definitely didn't want, and he felt that this would give expression to like the anger and the despondency about elections that people, particularly young people, feel. And then he went on to say that this anger is been expressed by Russell Brand, and he was saying that obviously he's taking Russell Brand very seriously, but he went on to say that Russell Brand's alternatives were nothing to do with politics, and that it was definitely not the way to go. I just think it suggests that, you know, the establishment is rattled really by Russell Brand and what he said a couple of weeks ago. I'm conscious of the people relating to what he said, and also I think it suggests that they're worried that his ideas might actually have an impact.
I don't think the discussion of this meeting cannot be separated from the internal disputes that's happening in the party. I think most of them have different experiences over the last year or so, but ironically we've all come to similar conclusions from those different experiences, and there's been no broad dissent amongst this branch. But for me, that one of the things that influenced or deepened some of my thinking was about Marxism and one of the meetings on Leninism. I know several people went to a meeting which was quite heated. The platform was Esme Shinero. I think it's Neil Davison. I may have got that name wrong, but I think it's Neil Davison. There's an article responding to an article of his in this month's journal. And then a guy from America. And for me, Esme wiped the floor with the opposition. Really did. And the reason she wiped the floor was she was very clear about what we're about. And what we're about is we're a revolutionary party. Mm. And it seems to me that a lot of the... I prefer the word critics rather than opponents, because I think it's more than just the faction or the factions, whether they've got an outside critics, an outside people. It's about critics. And to me, many of those of the critics, whether internal or external, are either disillusioned, or I've never believed in revolutionary socialism, or believed that we're never going to get there, and it's never going to happen. And I think that's the essential difference between those that are supporting the Central Committee and those that are being critical of each other. The critics either have never believed in revolutionary socialism, or they've abandoned that belief. And I think that's what made Esme's arguments that clear, not just because she could quote Lenin better than anybody else or whatever, but because she was clear about what she was about. And for me, that's why I'm quite a supporter of the Central Committee, because at some of the meetings we had, the meeting we had the other week in the aggregate, that the Central Committee has a clear, you know, knows what it's about, and the arguments that's coming out of that reflect that. That's not happening in any of the critics, where from whatever angle that they're going, because they lack that clarity.
I think what's really interesting about the Russell Brand stuff, I absolutely agree with Anne that you know, on some issues, it's quite simple to decide which side you're on, because when the attack dogs of the ruling class lay into somebody and start to slag them off, and you know, then you know generally they must be doing something right. And it's okay. So the initial response to the Russell Brand thing was whole sections of what you call the commentariat. You know, the sort of people who write the leading articles in newspapers and appear on Newsnight, where they're just sneering, who do you think he is? This anti-politics thing. You know, politics is about the real world, isn't it? About reality, a compromise, whatever. This is our anti-politics, nihilistic, fascistic, even, because you start to talk about is all about voting, therefore that makes him somehow anti-democratic. Therefore, all that. So you know when those people are having a go, that all your instincts say you support someone that. Even though I think that, you know, we could sit here if we want to and pick holes in elements of what Russell Brand said, and say, you know, what he fails to understand is not quite, which is quite right. But that's not really the point. And I think the point about it is, and I think I've read Aubrey to some extent, what I think what Russell Brand has done by articulating, as Marx said, that sort of mood, if you want, not a developed revolutionary consciousness in any sense, really, but a sort of general sort of mood about the nature of the world in which we live, the us and them, the 99% and the 1%, all that stuff, which has become a set of ideas which permeate amongst lots of people at some level or another. By articulating them, I think it's really important. And I think what he does, and he didn't mean to do this, he's doing something that a famous Marxist philosopher called George Lukács used the phrase the actuality of revolution. And what he meant by the actuality of revolution is the idea that actually in a capitalist society, despite all the sort of normalisation and the way in which bourgeois society normalises the oppression and exploitation that goes on under capitalism, that the potential, the germ, the actuality of revolution is there. The potential for revolutionary change is there. And I think what Russell Brand's contribution does is, I mean, I'm sure Russell Brand's never read a new question or whatever. He hasn't got conscious, but he's articulating that idea of the actuality and the potential for revolutionary change. Now, that doesn't mean, and no one runs from saying this, that we're about to have a revolution in Britain tomorrow, and that's not the case at all. There are all sorts of very, very powerful forces in society. Mark hasn't talked about the Labour Party, he has talked about trade union bureaucracy, lots of other things, which act as a real dampener, don't they, on any sort of potential for revolutionary change. And those are real forces in society that those of us who want to bring about revolutionary change have to combat and have to develop strategies about how we put alternatives to and challenge, etc., etc. But it does point, I think that's really important about it, and I think Aubrey's absolutely right in terms of debates about what sort of the left and how the left orientate, I think that's a really important argument, because if you are a revolutionary socialist, then you have to have a sense that the possibility, however difficult it is, and however potentially distant it might be, the possibility and actuality of revolution is there. And I think that is really, really important. And again, I mean, one of the themes that have been coming up in meetings over the last 2 years is the whole question about the Egyptian revolution. And I think if you think about the Egyptian revolution, you know, that has, and Mark talked about the ups and the downs, and the up and up like a rocket and down like a stick. I mean, it's a hugely powerful revolutionary movement, but it's had its ebbs and flows, hasn't it? It has, you know, it's had its huge heights, and then it's had its moments where the ruling class have, and quite successfully over recent months, reasserted control, pushed the revolution down, etc., etc. People should read the stuff in this week's Socialist Worker about the, you know, beginnings of the re-emergence of mass struggle again on the streets in Egypt, because all the old contradictions are there, aren't there? The basic demands of the revolution for bread, justice, and what they call bread, justice, and social progress, wasn't it? The three, not bread, land, and peace, but the three key demands. All those things remain unresolved for millions and millions of Egyptians, and at the same time, millions and millions of Egyptians have learnt the experience over the last 2.5 years that actually revolutionary action can. And that, so those lessons are still there. So, you know, the potential for that to take off is absolutely there. So I think that's really, I think that stuff is really, really important.
Jenny?
Yeah, I mean, we've been giving out leaflets to the students at the college about the meeting. And when Russell Brand was first on, the students were saying, Russell Brand is right. You know, that it certainly had an enormous echo with whole numbers of students that we met. And some were saying, Albert, he's a sexist shit, which is true. His behaviour towards women in the past has not been good. But he's connected in some way. And the bit I like best on the video was Paxman says, "But it's pie in the sky, what's it going to be like after your revolution?" And he says, "I don't know, we'll make it out of the revolution." Was absolutely right. You know, the point about a revolutionary movement is people change in the process of it. Mm-hmm. Marx had this phrase, the emancipation of the working class is the act of the working class. And actually in the process of struggle, whether it's, you know, the firefighters over the cuts in town today, or massive upheavals like they had in Egypt, in the process of that, people change and can begin to see the germ of a different society. And at the core of that germ is that we don't want a society built on profit, which is why he's absolutely right when he says it should be a dirty word. And I didn't hear the beginning of the PM programme, I heard the second bit where they were talking about bloody Boris Johnson. Not John, yeah, do I mean Boris? Yeah. Mm. You know, Boris has said that greed is good again. Mm. You know, the slogan from the 80s, yeah. Geico in the film Wall Street, he's saying, you know, we need that people need to compete and they need to get on, and we need to understand that, I know, 20% of the population haven't got the IQ to get on, and so how they educate doesn't really matter. All the most reactionary stuff. He sort of tempered it a little bit, but it's all coming out. And I think, as Anne said, I think it's really, you know, they're rattled. And, you know, we have to keep on making them rattled. And the other people who are rattled, actually, by are the Labour Party, because we had the political officer of the Labour Party talking to us on the stall today. She came up and she was talking about megaphone politics. She was having a good go at Socialist Worker. Oh, it's easy having a petition about fuel prices and all the rest of it, but she said this is an important one, so she was having a go. And then she said, we have to understand that behind the fight to fight the cuts, there are county councillors and local councillors taking really difficult decisions. I know some of them are in tears about it. And I just said, well, they wouldn't need to cry if they voted against them. And everybody on the streets of Chester...
Sorry, I'm going to have to take this.
You know... You could feel that people don't want the bloody fire service cuts, and if somebody would only stand up and say we're not doing it, they would, you know, we could have that potentiality would be out there. And she just looked at me as I did come from a different planet when I said it. But the woman who was talking to Lucretia at the time, I think it was right, and I told you the story, she said, you're right. That's what they should do. Mm-hmm. And it, you know, if you're not in that position, it just seems so obvious, but they get sucked into this realpolitik, the way that, you know, and that's what Paxman can't understand, it's what Boris can't understand, and what we have to tap into.
Yeah, I'm quite pleased we're having this discussion tonight, because when Russell Brand came out with all of this stuff, the first thing that came into my head was, what the hell is this guy saying this for? Because of his history. I mean, we know him as a sexist git and so forth and whatever. But then the more I sort of thought about it, the more I thought, well, you know, if we have somebody who is famous and who has a large following, and he's saying largely the right thing, then is it a bad idea? Because, I mean, don't forget the other side. They've got their bloody comedians as well, don't they? You've got that guy on Top Gear, you know, he's flying the Tory flag all the time and so forth and whatever. So, yeah, so I'm quite pleased we're having the debate. But I just wanted to come back around, because Mark, in his talk, he mentioned the unions and so forth, and some of the setbacks of the unions and whatever. And he mentioned the one that's in everybody's mind about Unite up in Grangemount. And I mean, that was an incredible setback for the movement, I think. But what's interesting about the Unite thing was, you know, they absolutely had a chance to really do something, because the power of those workers, it would have been incredible if they occupied the factory and so forth. But, they didn't, and, you know, we know the problems there. But we, obviously, within Unite being a union of 1.5 million or something like that members, you do have different factions in it, and our people within Unite constantly argued after that and took every opportunity that they got. They went to meetings and so forth and argued that the tactics that was used over Grangemount was wrong. And obviously, in the paper, you'll hear McCluskey saying, I did the right thing, I protected 800 jobs, I did blah de blah de blah, so forth and so forth and so forth. But he has actually, with pressure from our comrades within Unite, he has actually admitted that, yes, okay, for the first time, he has admitted that mistakes were made and we have to learn from those mistakes. And I think, yes, we got the right ideas, and yes, because really something like Grangemount was like a body blow to a lot of us. But, you know, when he's pushed, McCluskey and people like that, when they are pushed, and when they do actually backtrack a bit, it just shows that, you know, with enough pushing, you know, we can actually get there.
The type of socialism we study is not the socialism of bleeding hearts or please stop doing this to us. It's the other kind. It's making them stop. It's a socialism of objective conditions. And the Grangemouth thing, like, I mean, sometimes, like, your fighter's got to get a kick in to remember how to defend himself. And that was round one. As a class, we've got to take some more beatings yet before we, as a class, stand up, and we're going to have to get bloody noses, black eyes, and the whole lot, metaphorically. the objective conditions, we've got to force a state where it's not a choice about whether to move to an increase in democracy, and I think that's got to be a sort of linchpin, because the people will be sent against us, will be there defending democracy in their eyes. And so we need to be more democratic. We need a pro-democracy movement. And, because we've got to be more democratic than the other guys. There's no alternative but that.
Real democracy.
Real democracy.
Real democracy.
From below.
Yeah. Thanks, Tom. Jane.
I understand where Tom's coming from, but actually I disagree, because I think we need some bloody victories. And that's the problem, isn't it? We have been through, since the miners' strike in the mid-80s, you know, a period where, for 20, 25 years nearly, of people fighting back and actually ending up often getting beaten. And that has a real effect, I think, on people's confidence in this country to fight. And it isn't, I think Russell Brand's absolutely right, people do want a different sort of world. But actually we have got a real problem, because we are talking about a movement that has been beaten back, where every single fight matters, because every single fight that takes place actually gives the group of workers that are on, you know, involved in that strike, be it the firefighters or be it the teachers or whoever, confidence. But actually to the rest of us, you know, you feel like, it's a bit like getting in a scrap, innit, where you think, go on, have a go, I'll hold your coat. I haven't quite got the confidence of mine in myself, but bloody give them one, you know, come on. And you feel like that, don't you? You want it, and you think, if you just get one good, you know, one good go, that's great. And the problem is, and I think Mark's right, that we've got leaders in our own movement, be it in the Labour Party or in the trade unions, that, you know, when that happens, are scrambling to some sort of deal, you know, and have to be pushed and shoved and, you know, absolutely levered, if you like, by the pressure from below to do something, to shift something. And I think that, you know, the difference it would make, if you think about, talked about the teachers, you think about the probation officers, the firefighters, all the different groups of workers that have taken action over the past couple of months, if the TUC got off its, you know, made good its words and got off its backside and said, yes, we'll name a day where all of the public sector will stand up to the Tories, and yes, profit is a bloody dirty word, and actually we will fight, and gave a lead, what a difference that would make, because we've got a problem, haven't we? People are angry, but there's a big difference between being angry and having the confidence to do something about it. And it's that difficulty, that's where we're at, isn't it? So people can be boiling furious, but having the confidence to say, yeah, I want to do something, you know, is something different. And if you haven't got a leadership in your own workers' movement that is going to do it, it's very, very hard. And it actually makes it more difficult for people. So there's that sense of hesitancy and waiting for them to do something and having to push them when they do. And, you know, so I think a few victories would actually make a very big difference. And we have had some, actually. But the problem is that we don't all feel it. You know, not all workers know about them. And they're small and they don't generalise. And it's not enough of it. So that's a difficulty, I think, about the kind of period we're in at the minute. So it means every struggle that there is, whether it's against a bedroom tax or it's strikes or whatever it might be, we've got to be absolutely building it and stoking it and making it as big as we can. But I think the other thing I wanted to say is that I think the movements on their own aren't enough, are they? And you get a sense when, I suppose it is a bit of a criticism of what Russell Brand said, you get a sense of, yeah, he's absolutely right and it's fantastic he's saying it, but how do we get there then? What does that mean, you know, practically now? What about right now? How do we do that? And I think it is about having an organisation actually that brings together the best people that want to fight inside the working class, but as an organisation that has some politics that talks about, you know, what we can do right now, how we can build solidarity and struggle right now, but actually does then say, but there's a point to that. It's not just about winning right now. It's because we want to actually change the world, and that will take something bigger. It'll take the mass of ordinary working people, you know, saying they've had enough, and they're gonna literally take over society, because that's what revolution is. It's people like us, it's a 99% taking over society and running it for themselves. But I think the other thing that we have to talk about in that is, do we just mean a people's revolution, or do we mean a particular type of revolution? Because there's a bit of a difference, isn't there? You know, if it's just a people's revolution, that's great, but actually where's the real power lie to change things fundamentally? And it has to be about organised workers. It has to be about people that have the power to stop the profit, to stop the dirty word, you know, to turn off that profit and that system. And I think that's why being in a party like this is really important for me, because, you know, you're bringing together the best fighters, but we also have to argue that at the end of the day, you know, a revolution can happen, but what it ends up in will absolutely depend on who made it, who created it. You know, if it's ordinary working people that have the power to do that, then actually we have the power to build a better world. But it has to be concentrated in that way, I think, on organised workers. And I think sometimes that's a bit of a problem with what you look at in Egypt, isn't it? That, you know, they got so far and you think, oh, go on, go on, go on. And then there were strikes, you know, in the clothing factories and the cotton, you know, and all of that sort of thing started to happen, and new unions started to happen. You think, go on, go on, go on. But it doesn't naturally go forward, does it? You know, not all things naturally go forward and upward. So there are setbacks and there are difficulties. And the reason we need a revolutionary organisation, the party, is because we have to have arguments about what do we do with those setbacks. How do we react to them? How do we build? How do we come back again? You know, what do we do? Because it isn't just an onward and upward thing, I think. You know, revolutions aren't like that. There are all kinds of problems with them. So I think that's really, really important. But I wanted to ask a question, really, about another thing, perhaps that wasn't discussed, was about the role of the army, the role of the police, the role of the people that protect the profit, the role of the people that protect the 1%. You know, what about them? What do we say about them? And would a revolution have to be violent? Would we actually need to have violence? Because a lot of people that I talked to that saw Russell Brand, they were saying, my God, you know, he wants us all to take up arms immediately. I don't think he was saying that at all. But, you know, there is a question, isn't there, about how do we actually get there then? Mm. Yeah, what about that? What about the violence that they can use to prevent us and stop us? What do we do?
That was some contributions from the floor following last Thursday's meeting on Can There Be a Revolution in Britain? Of course, if you'd like to contribute to the discussions of future meetings, then come along on Thursday nights from 7:30. Anyway, there was also another contribution made later on, a really good contribution or question from Lucretia about the middle class, although I think that the middle class is a subject all of its own, which does deserve a meeting in its own right, really. Anyway, back to the music. This next track's going out from Tim to Jane with Buckets of Respect. Sound of Led Zeppelin, track entitled All of My Love.
Radio Resistance Chesterfield.
My love. cloth, mine is the hand that sews time. His is the force that lies within. Ours is the fire, all the warmth we can find. He is a feather in the wind. Earth, all of my love to you now.
This is the Radio Resistance Red Guide. A guide to meetings and events of interest to left-wingers in the Chesterfield area. On Thursday, December the 12th, there's the Chesterfield branch of the Socialist Workers' Party's branch meeting. How the Tories are wrecking education. Michael Gove is leading the Tories into a full-scale assault on education, determined to turn our schools, colleges and universities into privately run businesses. What is the Tory vision for our education system, and what is our socialist alternative? This will be held in Chesterfield Library at 7:30 p.m. Enter by the cafe entrance on Beetle Street, which is down the steps from the main entrance. Then on Wednesday, December the 11th, Chesterfield Post Office are holding a consultation meeting on the closure of Chesterfield Post Office and its move to WH Smith's. This will be held at Chesterfield Hotel. Come along and show your opposition to this move, which would be disastrous for workers and disastrous for the postal service. Remember, what the working class needs a party which will not sell out to a right-wing agenda to gain middle-class votes. What the working class needs a party which will not kowtow to the bosses and the ruling class. What the working class needs is a party which is run by and for the working class. The Socialist Workers' Party is that party.
Don't get sick because the ward shut. They get the bonus, we get the cuts. We can take it lying down, but too many lies and the world goes blind. Learn the lessons of the past. It's the race to the bottom of the class. This shit won't always pass. It's a kick up the ass from tragic big force. They're cutting out the heart. I'm trying to send a station. Wake up this condemnation. We got a new world in our hearts. We can make it if you play your part. Get a taste of your station. Kickstart this condemnation.
Yeah, the sound there of the faction Condemnation, and during this week while the station was off air, we got this message sent to us via the microwave link here at Radio Resistance. Now the message was as follows.
Radio Resistance.
We have watched you for many weeks.
We love your show.
We have observed you.
And we're coming to get you.
Now, what's all that about, and how did they find the link frequency out? Curiouser and curiouser. Anyway, if you'd like to contact us by more conventional means, then you can contact us by email at radioresistancechesterfield@yahoo.co.uk. You can phone or text us on 0793 479 3041. That's 0793 479 3041. You can search for Radio Resistance Chesterfield on Facebook, like the page, and then send us a message on Facebook or leave a message on our wall. If you're listening to us on someone else's radio and you'd like to know how you can listen to us yourself on your own PC, then you can log in at sail.to/radioresistance. That's sail.to/radioresistance. Or we've also got a backup site if that doesn't work, which is at www.reddisability.org/radio-resistance. That's www.reddisability.org/radio-resistance. Anyway, that's about all we've got time for this week, so hope to catch you again next week. Assuming that the link frequency doesn't get jammed again. I'm going to, since it's December now, I think we can afford to start putting a few Christmas records on, so I'm going to sign off with the sound of Jonah Louie. Bit of an anti-war Christmas song, Stop the Cavalry.
Hey, Mr. Churchill comes over here to say we're doing splendidly. But it's very cold out here in the snow, marching to and from the enemy. Oh, I say it's tough, I have had enough, can you stop the cavalry? Say, oh yes, yet again, can you stop the cavalry? Mary Bradley waits at home in the nuclear fallout zone. Wish I could be dancing now in the arms of the girl I love. Double-a-ba-dum-dum, double-a-ba-dum, 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 double-a-ba-dum. Wish I was at home for Christmas. Bang, that's another bomb on another town. While those are and Jim Hefty. If I get home, lift up, tell the tale, I'll run for all presidencies. If I get elected, I'll stop. I will stop the cavalry. Wish I was at home for Christmas.